Welcome to Current Management of Chronic Myeloid Leukemia. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this roundtable-style program, I was joined by faculty members Dr. Jorge Cortez, Michael Morrow, and Neil Shah, and by Drs. Tina Botniger and Amanda Blackman to present cases to the faculty. To begin, I asked the investigators about their thoughts on the data of ASC4FIRST, a pivotal Phase 3 trial of frontline asciminib that was recently presented at the ASCO 2024 meeting.
I think it was very remarkable. Honestly, I thought that's kind of what I would have expected, knowing that the asciminib's potential in third line and T315I and all of that. That was the intention to try to get to better results in the front line. Clearly, what we're seeing is the early responses. There's a lot to be seen in the long term, and we want to focus on that. But I was very satisfied with the efficacy and the safety that was seen on these early data to suggest that it is a step forward, and I think it's good to have an additional option for patients if this gets to be approved.
Neil, I'm just kind of curious. You know, we know a lot of our audience has only been in oncology 5 or 10 years. We have a lot of fellows, so a lot of people aren't familiar. Kind of didn't live through the CML story. When you, again, thinking about this presentation, this data in light of what had preceded, any thoughts that you had as you saw it presented?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I certainly expected it to be better than imatinib, right? We know the second generation drugs are better than imatinib. I expected it to be very tolerable just based on, you know, my clinical experience in the third line setting. And, you know, I think it is. I think there are some unanswered questions, related to cardiovascular issues, which, you know, with 1 year of follow-up, we're not seeing much, which is great. But, you know, I don't think... unless a drug really has a strong signal like ponatinib, you know, I don't think we're going to see a lot after only 1 year. I think maybe after 3 years or after 5 years, we'll get a better sense of that. It's, you know, the fact that it was, I guess, numerically better than the second generation drugs, you know, is intriguing. It's not enough to say that it's, you know, from a statistical significance standpoint, superior, but at least it looks no worse. So, you know, I will echo what Jorge said in that, you know, I think it's fantastic to have, you know, more options, especially, you know, if we think that most patients, the majority of patients are going to need long-term therapy, you know, tolerability on a day-to-day basis is a really important thing for patients. So, yeah, I was definitely pleased to see that the data, you know, look largely as expected. Yeah.
Michael, anything you want to add to that? And again, you know, I mean, to me, it seemed like really, I mean, of course, we've been following this story for a while, but seeing that data presented to me seemed like a real landmark, but you tell me.
No, I agree as well. I think it's important to remember it's building on a very long and very extensive Phase 1 trial and a Phase 3 trial in later line. So, you know, I was hoping, as everyone else was, that we'd see superiority in certain elements. I think the trial design was very good. I think it's very defendable. When you're asking how could you prove a drug was a better potential choice in the front line, Neil's comment about the numerical difference versus statistical difference compared to imatinib in the front line is important. I would point people who have questions about tolerability to the long-term follow-up from the Phase 1 study in pretty heavily pretreated patients, people that had other TKIs. I don't think we would see less toxicity in that population. We might even see more because those patients had other drug exposures. And I think it's quite encouraging that the safety was no, there were no new issues, and asciminib brings really a big step forward with a safe alternative in multiple settings for me in the clinic, and I think probably a preferred advantage in the frontline. I get it that there's probably, we could have a pretty robust debate about how we should be using it, but I think I expect it to be approved, and I'm going to be a big fan.
Yeah, we should have a little bit of that debate. Tina, any thoughts and any questions you'd like to hear the other faculty discuss about the study?
No, I mean, I've used asciminib in the third line setting and beyond, and I've been impressed by the way my patients have handled it compared to the toxicities they experienced on other TKIs. So I remember waiting for asciminib to be approved even in that setting. And so it's very cool to see it move further up the food chain. Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that there are some questions in terms of whether or not this is going to become our standard of care in frontline CML management, and how are you going to manage those patients who ultimately experience toxicities on asciminib, or if they develop resistance mutations like the T315I mutation, and, you know, asciminib is unable to abrogate it. So I think, you know, for me as a practicing oncologist, I'm not sure that I would adopt it in the frontline setting yet, but I did think that the frontline data looked really promising. I would just need to see longer term follow-up.
Amanda, any thoughts or questions?
So my question would be, when are we going to actually start using this frontline? I've had some colleagues try to get it, and insurance has been an issue. Has anyone successfully used this frontline at this time?
Yeah, so it's not yet FDA approved. I think, you know, the expectation is it may be within the next month or two. At that point, you know, of course, I think hopefully insurance companies will agree to pay for something that's FDA approved. But as we know, sometimes, you know, even though it's approved in the third line, sometimes I get pushed back about, you know, using it in the third line because a patient hasn't tried one specific TKI that the insurance company wants them to take before trying asciminib.
Michael, sort of putting aside access and regulatory issues, just looking at risk-benefit right now, what are the situations where you'd like to use asciminib first line?
I have to admit that since I've been able to use it for almost a decade now, I'm feeling pretty comfortable. So, and I think about, you know, highest reward, lowest risk, I really think it might meet that benchmark in frontline. So I'd like to use it pretty broadly in frontline. What would seal the deal for me would be if we started to see treatment-free remission eligibility and success improve. I think that's an important follow-up. So, you know, I'm going to be diplomatic in my statements about how much we should be using in the frontline for now until we see how that pans out, but I'm probably going to be one of the most exuberant, you know, users in the front line because I feel very comfortable with it over a very long experience. I can bank off that for safety and tolerability.
Yeah, you know, we know that everyone understands we have to individualize treatment decisions, but, you know, oncologists want to know, really, again, putting aside the regulatory issues, how you view, you know, the pure benefit in terms of risk and benefit. Jorge, if you know, cost and, you know, access wasn't an issue, what situations, if any, would you want to use asciminib first line?
Well, you know, the first thing I think when somebody asks me something like that is, what would I take if I had CML? Well, I would take asciminib. I don't know how big the difference is going to be versus second generation TKIs in the long term, and particularly with Mike mentioned, our main interest right now is TFR eligibility and success. Survival is not the point anymore. You know, we've reached the probably the ceiling of survival. But if I want to reach the TFR eligibility, that's what I want. Now we've kind of said, well, you know, for patients who are not as focused on TFR, you probably can go with imatinib. Mostly because of concerns about safety, arterio-occlusive events with nilotinib, probably some with dasatinib, the pleural effusions, you know, all these things. But because of the low risk of safety issues, particularly arterio-occlusive events, and as Mike said, you know, we've been using the drug for 10 years in the phase one, I think that anybody could be a good candidate for asciminib. Now, let's remember, the other drugs are good, and imatinib is a good drug. And imatinib is generic, so if somebody cannot access asciminib, I'm not giving them anything bad by treating them with imatinib. I'm okay treating them with imatinib. So the good thing is that we have good options for anybody, but I would prefer asciminib.
Yeah, just kind of curious about, you know, as I mentioned, we do stuff throughout oncology. You know, CML is the model for targeted therapy. But, you know, once you get outside of CML, it's hard to see an instance where it's successful in the kind of model that's evolved. For example, you know, EGFR mutant or ALK mutant, non-small cell lung cancer, third generation TKIs, et cetera. They're still recurring. They're still dying. Any thoughts about sort of from a basic biology point of view, Jorge, why we haven't been able to reduplicate this model?
I mean, there's a couple of reasons. One is, you know, CML is a more indolent disease than, you know, for example, in my world, AML or ALL or, you know, lung cancer or pancreatic cancer, you know, those are much more aggressive. So a failure of the therapy in those instances has very immediate implications, whereas in most instances, CML, a failure of a therapy, still gives you the opportunity to try something else, to plan, to, you know, to do, you know, other options, transplant included, which we probably have not used as much as we should in some instances. Now, on the other hand, we are learning that, and, you know, historically we've considered CML as this very pure, molecularly pure disease that has this one abnormality, you block it, you're fine. Of course, now we're learning that that's not the case. And these instances where there are mutations in other genes associated with cancer, ASXL1 and others, they're actually pretty difficult to manage. And these patients progress quickly and so on. So that subset of patients, which is fortunately a minority, they are probably more like these other cancers. Probably not quite as bad, but still they're more like that than these nice picture that we have in our mind about CML. You diagnose, you give them a TKI, they're going to have a normal life expectancy.
Michael, any thoughts?
I think that CML was sort of a paradigm for targeted therapy. I think we have other examples that are a bit close, maybe in CLL and some other spaces where we are looking at time duration limited therapy, but it's not exactly the same. I mean, even GIST, where we had a similar target and a similar use of a TKI, we saw multifocal disease and multifocal resistance. So I think as Jorge might have said, I think it just boils down to the genesis of CML, that it's the first human cancer linked to a genetic abnormality, but interestingly, it's so BCR-ABL driven and BCR-ABL persistently driven. 25 years ago, people were estimating clearly we would have had another mechanism of resistance that would have usurped BCR-ABL inhibition by now, and we don't. We're talking today about a more potent, you know, an allosteric BCR-ABL inhibitor rather than whatever the next thing that CML decided to use as an activator. So,
getting back to that, I want to come back to asciminib. So, Neil, when you sit down with your first-year oncology fellows, you know, how do you explain to them sort of your vision of the pharmacology of CML and why asciminib is different from the other TKIs?
Sure. So, the first five approved TKIs, you know, are ATP competitive. So, kinases, you know, by definition, will bind ATP and hydrolyze one of the terminal phosphate, and then use that, attach that to the substrate, a tyrosine residue on a downstream protein, and the net result of all that is going to be cellular growth. And of course, you know, this is a very effective way to target signaling. But since many proteins bind ATP, there are many kinases. There are not only tyrosine kinases, there are serine threonine kinases, there are lipid kinases. It's obviously very challenging to develop a potent and highly super selective kinase inhibitor that will only hit, for instance, your target of interest. And so all the kinase inhibitors do hit other closely related kinases. In some cases, KIT, PDGFR, SARC family kinases, and so on. Now, asciminib takes a different approach. It builds on our understanding of the physiologic regulation of ABL, where the first exon encodes the amino terminus of normal ABL and helps tightly regulate its kinase activity through binding through this myristate pocket, which is not really that close to the ATP binding pocket. And this binding induces this closed inactive conformation where you have these other domains clamping down, as it were, on the kinase domain. You can still bind ATP, but it shuts off basically downstream signaling. And so that is that mechanism is really pretty unique to ABL1 and ABL2 kinases. And so as a result, asciminib really is very, very selective for these kinases relative to others. And so there's certainly the hope that this may translate to improved tolerability. And obviously, it's a stretch to always assume that a particular toxicity that somebody may have on a TKI is due to kinase inhibition, because these drugs can potentially, you know, interfere with other proteins. But yeah, that's more or less how I explain it. Maybe the last thing I will say is that, you know, our understanding of the ATP competitive inhibitors and their vulnerabilities, you know, it taught us about, basically the vulnerabilities for those fall into two classes, you know, those that directly impair drug binding, and those that maybe impair the conformation required for the drug to bind. In contrast, due to its mechanism of action, of course, asciminib is going to be vulnerable to mutations around its binding pocket, around this myristoyl binding pocket. But what we're learning is that mutations located some distance away from this binding pocket confer resistance. And so understanding how this is occurring is important. But, you know, the leading hypothesis is that because asciminib, you know, basically reinforces or induces this conformation, this physiologic conformation, that conformation depends on a lot of individual contacts between these various domains. And disturbing or interrupting those contacts through mutation could potentially represent, you know, vulnerabilities for asciminib that would not be issues for other drugs. So the good news is we would have other treatments for those. But, you know, I think the potential number of escape mechanisms for asciminib may be, you know, more than what we've appreciated so far, is likely to be more than what we've appreciated so far.
So interesting. Jorge, anything you want to add to that? And also your thoughts about right now that what we know based on trials and also your own clinical experience in terms of tolerability issues, asciminib versus imatinib, for example, asciminib versus second generation drugs.
Well, you know, more than that, because the description that Neil did was just beautiful and, you know, very, very informative. But I do want to highlight one thing that he already mentioned, is this, this is so much more, this pocket is so much more specific for the ABLE, and that's probably why we see less of some of the off-target adverse events. Now, we need to keep in mind that probably some of the adverse events that we see are on-target, and maybe, you know, some of these things we will continue seeing, but it certainly makes it as clean as you can have, because of that mechanism of action. We also are starting to learn more about these mechanisms of resistance, and Neil also alluded to this, and this graphic that you have up there in terms of the mutations that affect one or the other, generally speaking, they're correct. You know, we think about the myristoyl pocket affecting asciminib, myristoyl pocket mutations affecting asciminib, ATP binding pocket affecting the other tyrosine kinase inhibitors. But we are seeing that there are mutations that are emerging with asciminib that are not what we initially had predicted as being resistant, or where we would have predicted that asciminib would work, and yet they're emerging as mechanisms of resistance. So Anil has done a lot of work on helping us understand why this happens. So I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind, that the as we continue using the drug, we will have to continue learning about its full mechanism of action and mechanisms of resistance. And I also want to bring up the point that we understand a lot about mechanisms of resistance through mutations. Many patients don't have mutations. Many patients don't have detectable mutations. And that, the mechanism of resistance for those patients, we understand it much less. I alluded earlier to the mutations in other genes, and I think that explains some of them. But it is an area, and it is not an insignificant number of patients where we don't have a mutation, and yet we don't know why the patient did not have a good response to the therapy that we predicted that would have worked.
Here are some of the data that Jorge presented. Of course, the data just presented. But Tina, anything you think might, not just for your own interest, but for your colleagues out there in the community, you think you'd like to hear the other faculty discuss and related to what we've just been saying?
No, I mean, I think it's been touched upon for the most part. I think the biggest question, obviously, asciminib is not currently approved, but just in general, with respect to CML management, I would love to hear about their approach and how they counsel patients on the different options for TKIs that are available in the frontline setting, management of, you know, some of the more common toxicities that we see up front, and, you know, just their general approach when they switch, and sort of their treatment goals for younger versus older patients.
A lot of that's going to come out in the cases, but I think that might be a great way to sort of get started, Michael. So first of all, can you talk a little bit again about some of the things that you saw in the first-line trial that you thought were of interest, what you're looking for as the trial matures further? And also Tina's question about right now, today, the nature, we'll get into this more, but globally, how you think through discussing upfront treatment with patients.
Sure. So if you just look at the trial, I mean, first the design question. So I did like the design. I wish it was randomized to all choices, the entire trial duration, but allowing for an investigator's choice to be predetermined and then a coin toss and then asciminib versus your best drug. I explain it to patients. It's like going to the track and saying, I don't want to run against that horse. I'll run against anyone that's willing to race me. So that was a good design to give an analogy. Frontline, we've set milestones that we expect to be benchmarks in our trials. Major molecular response as an early landmark. And that was the primary goal of the trial. In clinical practice, we don't necessarily demand that patients get an MMR at 12 months, but we aspire to have patients get an early MMR because it's very protective. It really limits progression, and it gets patients generally to higher odds of getting into deep molecular remission. So showing superiority versus imatinib and numerical improvements over second gens, that was important. That was, good historically compared to our other trials and really drove the message home. But I think a lot of people are almost equally or even more interested in the safety and tolerability because we know we have great therapies. Jorge highlighted that, imatinib's still a great drug. So I think the fact that tolerability was in some ways a little better with asciminib, some of the nuisance side effects, the non-morbid toxicities weren't there. I think the second gen versus asciminib with regards to any cardiovascular adverse events in the cardiovascular cardiopulmonary space being basically, dead even and very low was very encouraging. I think it told us that we didn't have a new signal here. Asciminib's going to be on the safer side. Of course, we want longer-term follow-up, but I think it delivered two hard messages that it is clearly better than imatinib. It is likely better than second gens, perhaps not, on a case-by-case basis, but it's got a better likelihood, and you're not going to bring any safety issues to the table. So how do we use that now? I think if you look, CML can be pretty complex, obviously, clinically, and I think we often start to get down the road of, intolerance and resistance can often be dual agendas or competing agendas or overlapping agendas. So I thought asciminib made a nice addition to the armamentarium by being a safer alternative compared to ponatinib in later lines of therapy. When you had a patient who was resistant to second-generation TKIs, there's been this message about recycling second-generation inhibitors really didn't get you very much long-term response or benefit, and you needed to move on to ponatinib. But there was always hesitancy regarding the risk of ponatinib. That's generally for resistant disease. Intolerance is always a bit more of a gray area, but they're often overlapping. So what I would say asciminib did is give us a clear option for the patient with resistance and intolerance that was mixed, and it also gave us the ability to use asciminib hopefully, you know, in earlier lines of therapy? I mean, as it is continued to be studied, can we use it as a second line inhibitor? And of course, we're all waiting for frontline approval.
So with that, I'm kind of going to turn this over to Tina and Amanda to present cases and query you about those. So let's start out with Tina. You've got a young patient, a 45-year-old man. What happened with him, and what would you like to hear the faculty discuss?
Okay. Yeah, so this is a patient I actually met on the inpatient consult service. Young guy, really minimal medical comorbidities, construction worker, used to doing a lot of hard physical labor, who had been doing well until a few days prior to admission when he basically presented with GI symptoms. And he's had them in the past, the GI symptoms, and they were evaluated. Essentially, his workup was negative. They did a CT scan in the ER, which showed marked splenomegaly. You can see it on the image here, but it measured 20 centimeters by 9 centimeters by 17 centimeters and was obviously very palpable on exam. His CBC showed a white blood cell count of 225.9. And that's why they consulted us. When you looked at the differential, it's what you see here. It's basically white blood cells in various stages of maturation, which looked very consistent with CML. Hemoglobin was fine at 12.1. Platelets were 286. The only other CBC I had on him was from 2 years prior, which was totally normal. He denied B symptoms, just abdominal pain and distension. I only saw a couple of blasts on the blood smear. He got a bone marrow examination, which confirmed what we thought he had, which was CML with just translocation 922 and no other secondary chromosome abnormalities and less than 5% blasts. So I elected to start him on dasatinib 100 milligrams a day about a little over a year ago. And you can see all of his PCR values since I diagnosed him. So he was responding actually quite well. So you can see where he was in April. His BCR ABL-IS was around 48%. And then 4 months later, it dropped to 1.5% and continued to sort of decline. And so he was doing okay on dasatinib, but he was experiencing some joint swelling and pain and actually ended up being diagnosed with hemorrhagic prepatellar bursitis 3 months after starting dasatinib and had an arthrocentesis. He had it recur in a few months later, but it was managed conservatively. So, you know, in this young guy, no other medical problems. I just wanted to see if you could comment on your approach to TKI selection in younger patients like this. I know one question I always get in young patients with CML when I'm going through the different available options for TKIs is which ones are the best. And so I have my own spiel, but I would love to hear how you discuss this with your patients.
Sure. So, I mean, I think many of us have been favorably impressed by the second gen TKIs, especially in younger patients. You know, one reason is because of the greater likelihood of getting to deeper responses, which could enable successful treatment-free remission. It's not dramatically higher with the second generation drugs, but it is higher. And if you have somebody this age, and you have an opportunity to potentially spare them decades of treatment and exposure to treatment, then that's quite appealing. So I generally do opt for second generation drugs in younger patients, certainly. And you know, we do feel that dasatinib and nilotinib have, you know, are very similar in terms of efficacy. They, you know, there's been a trial to actually demonstrate that. Bosutinib we know a little bit less about because it came later, and we just have, you know, probably less experience with it in the frontline setting. In part because, you know, nilotinib and dasatinib are excellent options. If for historical reasons, I have a lot of experience with dasatinib, and I just think, you know, if I had to take a drug twice daily on an empty stomach versus once a day with or without food, I know which choice I would make. But, you know, I just put them all out there on the table for the patient and describe, you know, what we know about them, what the risks are of one drug versus another. And I involve the patient in that decision. But yeah, my preference would definitely be for somebody younger like this, a second generation drug.
Neil, And this same patient turns to you and says, doc, you know, I heard about this new drug that came out. I know, I mean, it's not approved and all, but what would you do if it were you?
Well, I would say at this point, because it's not approved by the FDA, so I think it is entirely appropriate to start a second generation drug. If asciminib is approved in the not too distant future, and if the patient is either not responding well or is not tolerating treatment well, presumably once asciminib gets frontline approval, it already has third line and beyond. Presumably, it will also get second line approval at that point. So it could be, you know, an easy switch in the not too distant future is what I would say.
So, Michael, why don't you take Tina's second question? Tina?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, this patient generally tolerated dasatinib okay. His spleen started going down. You can see his PCR responses here, which I thought were excellent. And so when he developed these joint pains and these bursitis symptoms, we had several discussions about how to manage them because I couldn't exclude that this was related to dasatinib. And so the patient and I had several discussions about potentially holding dasatinib and seeing whether or not his joint effusions would resolve, but we did not because the patient was worried he would lose his response. So I would just be curious to know if you would have considered holding the dasatinib in this patient at some point.
I'll have to admit, I'm pretty worried about this younger patient with really robust disease, pretty, you know, high risk presentation. I really can't see how well his PCR is, but did he hit a milestone or not?
He did. You can see at 7 months, he was at 0.063.
Very good. Very good.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that's where the money is. So if someone is responding well to therapy, managing toxicity becomes a little bit obviously easier. So in an MMR, I think if you wanted to do a withdrawal and re-exposure challenge, given this inflammatory toxicity which he's having, bursitis sounds a little bit like some of the other things we see with dasatinib, with pleural and pericardial effusions, you know, sort of lymphocyte-driven, inflammatory, off-target effects. Sure, I think... The question you'd have in your mind is, well, where do we go from here? Let's say we say, he's dasatinib intolerant. Then you're looking at maybe moving laterally within the second generation group. I think bosutinib might be a good consideration there. Maybe it would have other toxicities to overcome, but it wouldn't have exactly the same. The other important point to make is dasatinib dose, there is a dose flexibility, I would say. There's reasonable data that 50 milligrams may even be, you know, an optimum dose. I think that's a debatable point. I think there's, you know, one can make a strong argument for, one can make a, you know, sort of a conservative argument against that it hasn't been put in a randomized trial. So lowering the dasatinib dose could be your path forward if you did have a drug hold and you said, oh, I'm relieving his adverse events, he's still in response. So you have to work with the patient, but you want to be careful in a high-risk patient like this. I think he's prime for developing resistance or rapid regrowth kinetics, given how he presented.
So Amanda, in a second, I'm going to allow you to ask any questions about this case you'd like to see the rest of the faculty discuss. But first, Tina, can you present to Jorge your third question?
Yeah, so... you know, this is all the pre-asciminib data and everything. And so I generally tell my patients that if you're going to have toxicities on these second generation TKIs, they're probably, I mean, they can happen anytime, but, you know, we typically see them early on and they usually resolve. And this patient's arthralgias and everything, they did resolve. Like, he is doing really well now clinically and has absolutely no concerns. The only thing is that he's due to see me actually very soon. And his last PCR that was checked showed a very slight uptick in the IS percentage. It was previously 0.063 in January, and then it went to 0.146. So it did go up. And My question is, you know all about his presentation, as we've talked about. It's an aggressive presentation. And so what would you make of this result? At what point would you repeat the he's going to get his PCR repeated. He's due to have that done. But at what point do you check for resistance mutations in these patients? At what point in their molecular monitoring do you consider switching?
Jorge?
At this point, I don't make too much out of this uptick. You know, it is modest. It's clearly not quite a one log increase. So the tests have a coefficient of variability, many labs around half a log or something like that. So I tend not to jump into something radical after just a small change like this. Obviously, the trends are more important, and particularly early on, you see a lot more of these bouncing around, and I want to see the trends. Now, this is a patient that I would not wait 6 months to check again. I would like to check again in 3 months to see that that is just a minor variation and not a clear trend going up. Now, if this had been more like, the initial, if it was a 40 or something like that, well, that's different. And you still want to confirm because here and there we still see occasional technical things with the PCR, but that's less likely to be just a technicality. So, I think that we need to be cautious with over interpreting small variations of the test. After all, this patient is, even with the new one, just above an MMR level, so there's no urgency on doing anything immediate. And there's been some analysis of doing the test too frequent, and because of that variability, you can also be misled by repeating it repeating it in a week or something like that. So I kind of go with 3 months, especially if otherwise the patient is stable, if it's still at a level that I can accept, and this one is one that I can accept. So now when I do it again, I would probably request a mutation at that point, or at least get the sample for the mutation, because once you have the results, if it is really going up, then I do want to know if there's a mutation. If it went down, then I usually call the lab and say, don't run it, that's okay. So, but that would be, if you confirm that the patient is clearly losing their response and now it's above one, let's say, then it is worth checking for a mutation.
Amanda, any questions about this case or anything that's been said so far?
Yeah, so first one comment. I've had a few patients who've had a PCR done and then the lab at City of Hope, and we see this drastic, not huge, but enough of a difference to be concerned. So that would be one question I had here, especially at a community hospital. Was this patient tested in the same lab? Yeah, okay.
It was.
And then two questions about upfront management. So in terms of risk models, are we using the SoCal risk model, or what has been the, most accurate risk assessment model? And are we checking next generation sequencing in these patients up front now that we have more mutational data?
Neil?
Great questions. So just the first comment that you made was about the lab. And I think that's really important. Since the pandemic, most of my patients, I've been managing remotely and sending them to commercial labs. So another question or another comment you had in there was about testing for like myeloid malignancy associated genes. I would love to be able to do that regularly. And unfortunately, at this point, it can be hard to get insurance coverage for that, in my experience. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. I have been trying to encourage the NCCN CML panel to make that a recommendation, but many panel members basically feel like there aren't enough compelling data yet, what we would do with the information. I personally think we should be more proactive, but, without a consensus, it remains something that's not included in the NCCN CML guidelines, unfortunately, from my perspective. You had a third comment in there. I'm sorry.
Risk models.
Risk models, yeah. So, generally speaking, I mean, obviously the SoCal is got like the longest sort of traction and so on, and a lot of the studies were done with it. But you know, I think the UTOS is also reason. But you know, for the most part, in practice, I go with second generation drugs. It is true that you can treat a younger person with low risk disease with imatinib. But, you know, for the reasons that we've mentioned, a higher likelihood of getting to deep molecular response. And as others have mentioned, the ability to dial down on the dose and maintain efficacy and improve the side effect profile. I have some patients that are, you know, that I'll start on 100 and not only titrate down to 50, but maybe even down to 20 milligrams a day, and they can maintain their responses. And it's driven by side effects. But I think, I think in practice, I myself don't really use that so much for decision making. Certainly if they're intermediate or high risk, absolutely, you know, I'll go with a second generation drug.
Thank you.
So let's move on to another case. And my favorite part of the case is 84-year-old woman.
Yes. So this is an 84-year-old with a history of stage 3 colon cancer. She had a resection in 2012 and adjuvant FOLFOX. And then she was incidentally found to have a white count of 20 to 30,000 with a left shift. She did not have increase in the peripheral blasts. Her basophils were about 4%. Cytogenetics, peripheral blood was translocation 922, and then a marrow showed chronic phase CML. Her spleen was not enlarged. I started her on imatinib 400, and she really just did not tolerate it. She was anemic, thrombocytopenic, periorbital swelling, not eating much, and edematous. So I switched her to dasatinib 50 milligrams daily. She ended up with effusions with that, and we dose reduced her down to 20 milligrams daily, which she remains on. She did hit her time points with all of this, and her transcript level is low, and she's tolerating everything well. So my plan is really not to achieve a TFR in her. However, I'm wondering about the dosing and if we feel this will provide relatively long-term good control.
So, Michael, any thoughts?
Sure. So I think we maybe could have called this one in the air. You had an older patient who had a previously chemotherapy-treated bone marrow who had excessive myelosuppression. So that is not shocking. I think that's part of treatment effect. So sometimes you can work around it. Sometimes, you know, lower dose of imatinib or hold and restart. But on the other hand, you know, you switch to dasatinib with a dose that's probably got, again, pretty convincing data, maybe better tolerated. The toxicity still came. And, you know, pericardial effusion is a more ominous adverse event on dasatinib in my book and may be linked with, you know, pulmonary arterial hypertension, et cetera. I think back to the phase 1 study of dasatinib where 40 milligrams was really when we started to see activity. But, you know, if you look at her PCR, and you look at the fact that if she's on 20 now for a couple of years and is doing well, this is a clear-cut example of where you just want to keep the patient out of harm's way and not do any harm. TFR is lovely, but at 84, if you run her to the finish line of her normal life expectancy with a low dose of dasatinib in major molecular remission, I think you've done really well, and I wouldn't change a thing.
Tina, how about you bring in your 85-year-old lady?
Yes. So in the same theme of older adults with a chronic phase CML, I take care of this patient who is 85 years old. She has a history of atrial fibrillation and has had 9 ablations and has a pacemaker in place. She has chronic baseline renal insufficiency with a creatinine that runs between 1.2 to 1.3 and multiple skin cancers. She was diagnosed about 6 years ago with CML amidst workup for just incidental leukocytosis. She was otherwise feeling well. Around that time, she had atrial fibrillation as well, and she thought it was CML related. She started imatinib 400 milligrams daily in August of 2018. And she kind of auto-adjusts her doses based on her blood work without really telling anybody. But at some point, she ended up achieving a major molecular remission. And then she saw that her creatinine was going up, and she kind of did some of her own reading and saw that imatinib could do that. So she self-reduced her dose to 200 milligrams daily, which is what she was taking when I saw her. Her PCR started to uptick a little bit. The values that you're seeing here, again, and I'm sorry for the small print, do show that that over time, while she was on the 200 milligram dose of imatinib, her PCR started going up, and she reluctantly went up to 300 milligrams. She consistently tells me that her, her goals are to she doesn't necessarily need to achieve a perfect response. Like, she just wants adequately controlled disease and really minimal toxicities. So I was just hoping that you could comment on your treatment approach to older adults with CML and how stringent you are with respect to achievement of the treatment milestones in this age group.
Can you talk a little bit more about this woman's, as a person, what kind of work she's doing or has done? She has a kind of pretty proactive approach to treatment, interestingly.
No, she is 85 and she looks fantastic. I mean, she's very fashionable. She consistently tells me she is from New York City, not from West Virginia. She's a retired teacher. And so, she's, kind of on her own. I mean, she's kind of very self-reliant, splits her time between West Virginia and her home in Palm Beach, Florida. But anyway, very functional.
So, Neil, I would imagine you've seen a few people such as this patient in situations like this patient's. Any thoughts?
Yeah, and, the one thing that I'll just add to the previous discussion, which I think I can incorporate here, is that obviously, as we all get older, if we're fortunate to get older, and as our bodies start to fall apart, less in medical school, that I'm sure we all heard less is more, right? So less of a drug is necessary to achieve the same level of efficacy, and people are at greater risk of toxicity. In terms of the previous case, I'd say one thing that caught my attention was the rapidity with which side effects occurred. I think that patient was on imatinib for 1 month and then on dasatinib for 1 month before pleural and pericardial effusion. That's really unusual, especially like on reduced doses. Now, again, it could be just that it was, somebody who's got, aged organs, as it were. But I like to check for polymorphisms in cytochrome P450, 3A4, and 5 in such cases, because there are people who are slow metabolizers. And, most of these medications are metabolized through those pathways. And so it can be informative, not only for CML, but potentially for being treated with other medications, and potentially also for family members to see if they're potentially at risk for excessive drug toxicity. So I like to try to send that. But so back to this patient, certainly patients, sometimes will have their own ideas about or how much drug to take, and will experiment a little bit. I think that in this particular case, as you mentioned, the patient responded really well to imatinib. Obviously, a rise in serine creatinine at age 85 isn't necessarily due to imatinib, but it could be. And so, 200 milligrams, the number has been coming, the PCR number has been coming up a little bit, but really for the most part over the last year or so, it looks like it's been quite stable. So I'm not really so concerned that there's a drug resistant mutation causing this rise. I do think it's probably the lower dose. I would, probably feel a little bit more comfortable if she were potentially switched to a low dose of a second gen drug. So I might go to 20 milligrams of dasatinib, for instance, or maybe 100 or 200 to start with of bosutinib, or maybe 300 milligrams once a day of nilotinib, just to and then dose escalate as needed and as tolerated.
A question for Michael in terms of a little bit more about how he thinks through quote, older people. And I will say, people say age is just a number, but, statistically, in terms of life expectancy, 85 is very different than 92. That's very different than 78. And also, again, you have the patient's not only health profile, but also, as evidenced by this case, whether or not they want to be involved, and if they do, what their thoughts are about it. But any thoughts about this last question? And also, you know, anytime people bring up treatment-free intervals, the first word that comes out of their mouth is young people, and of course, but I think older people would like to get off treatment too. But anyhow, Michael, any sort of art of oncology and CML thoughts?
I would say it's complicated, Neil, but my personal view is that I want to be treated like I'm 19 when I'm 99 myself, but that's maybe a little bit of a personal bend. So I think it's probably just got to be a discussion. You have to really find out what the patient's goals are and put everything on the table, including TFR as an idea. But then you have to obviously be a good physician and assess their comorbidities and keep them out of trouble. I don't think it's our job to be too paternalistic to say, well, we're not going to be thinking about a TFR here. That could be disturbing to a patient here. Like, how come we're not thinking about getting me off this treatment? I hate taking pills. I already take a bowl of pills every morning. I don't want to take this drug any more than I have to. So the older patient, as many of my colleagues have nicely summarized, you know, clearly less, it may be more. Clearly, the adverse effects may be more, they weigh heavier. It's clear from, for example, the asciminib frontline trial. If you look at the age of those that were sort of allocated to amanda, it was older because we want to be more protective. We want to take the approach of being safer in our older patients. I'll be devil's advocate and say here that in these older patients where we have adverse effects and if response is not ideal, I think Neil's comment, low dose second generation TKI, there might be a place for asciminib or even lower dose asciminib in that setting. We haven't really studied that question, but that's an intriguing thought because I think it's quite a safe drug, and it could be for that fashionista patient who maybe wants to be availed to TFR so she can have more winters in Palm Beach than her peers, you know. So I think this is like I said, it's complicated. It's a discussion. Ask goals. Assess comorbidities. Keep all the options open. Don't be afraid to have a gentler touch in any patient. You know, the younger patients can suffer greatly with adverse effects too. They might need the same touch.
Such great thoughts. All right, let's go on to another case. Amanda, you have a 50-year-old woman.
Yeah, so this is a 50-year-old female with chronic phase CML who was intolerant of dasatinib. She was treated with imatinib. She achieved a major molecular response, and she came to me as a consult for when is the optimal time to try to achieve a TFR. So she was on the dasatinib 100 milligrams daily. She had a dose reduction to 40 milligrams daily due to nausea. And then it was titrated back up to 100 milligrams, but she was extremely tired, had a rash, she was nauseous and diffuse edema. So she was put on imatinib, which this should say 400 milligrams daily. She was interested in the TFR and had been on treatment for 3 years. You can see the trend of her transcript here on the right, and it was somewhere between MMR 3 and 4. She actually, you know, we discussed that some of the data showed that the longer that you're on the TKI, perhaps the more likely you are to achieve a successful TFR. So we decided to keep her on for 2 more years. And then she, after a lot more discussion, we were interested in trying a different second generation TKI. And we put her on bosutinib 200 milligrams daily. She does have diarrhea once or twice a day. She's taking Imodium pretty much once a day. It doesn't bother her. And she is fine with it as long as it doesn't cause her any long-term damage to her bowel. So would you go? So she actually asked me recently, would we go up on the dose of the bosutinib? But her transcript level already came down after a month being on the 200 milligrams. So I did not escalate it. So my questions are TFR after imatinib, and then the management of diarrhea with bosutinib.
So Jorge?
In terms of the TFR after imatinib, I wouldn't have tried it. I like the idea. I like the concept of MR 4.5 rather than MR 4. I think it, you know, of course, there's a tight correlation between duration of therapy and duration of the depth of response. But generally, the best studies, the best results have been in the studies that have used MR 4.5. And also the data, you know, we reported that a few years ago, and there's been more data on that showing that the longer the duration, the better. Now, it is a discussion with the patient. I do accept 2 years, but it's a discussion with the patient. You know, my minimum is 2 years. That is acceptable. And if you want to try, this is the data. The optimal is longer, and this is the data. And you know, you pick. You know, it's your choice. Just need to understand what are the pros and cons of one versus the other. But certainly my preference would have been to not discontinue at that point with imatinib when you only had MR 4.5, probably twice there, you know, and it's just a month difference. So it says it's essentially once, cause it's, you know, that test is the same. And then you had probably MR 4 one time that July 2023. So really this patient, never quite made it to a full criteria for TFR. So I agree with not having attempted that when they imatinib. Now, in terms of the bosutinib, and this is still early on the bosutinib, and the patient may, the diarrhea may improve over time. You know, after a month or two, you still see some diarrhea. This doesn't seem to be too bad. And very frequently, it improves over time. Obviously, what one or two bowel movements a day is for a patient is again, a physician, a patient's decision, because for some lifestyles, the, you know, a couple of bowel movements, if they're very loose, and that may be too difficult to manage for certain individuals because of the lifestyle, because of their preferences, whatever. Whereas for others, that's quite acceptable. So, you know, this patient seems to be okay with that. I think that's okay. In these instances, very frequently I see patients where eventually you can indeed try to go up in the doses. I wouldn't do it now because, as you said, there's already been a drop in the transcript level. So I don't need to push the dose. I need to see the outcome of the dose that I'm using. But if there was no improvement, then yeah, you could consider increasing the dose and see how the patient feels, you know, what happens with the diarrhea. Now, let's keep in mind, best case scenario, 10 years on the NSAID, only about half of the patients meet criteria for TFR. So, you know, we need to recognize that no matter how much we push with these drugs, you know, half of the patients, at least half of the patients will never get there. So that's a reality, unfortunately, with the drugs we have today, with the approaches we use today.
Tina, any thing you want to ask about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I have not attempted TFR after imatinib either, but I know other people have and have had variable success with that approach. The diarrhea on bosutinib, how, I was just curious to know how that was managed and whether or not the Imodium ended up taking care of things, or did you end up doing another dose reduction, or, you know, just.
She was taking the Imodium multiple times a day. It was up to like two or three times for the first couple of weeks, and then it did settle down a bit. So I did not reduce her dose because I expected at least some diarrhea to start with. In terms of the question of does this cause damage to her bowel long term, I can't really answer that one with certainty, but it seems like it does not. I don't know if there have been any cases of drug-induced colitis or any sort of colitis that needed to be managed more significantly.
Neil?
If I can just chime in. So I think this is somebody in whom I might consider either a reduced dose of nilotinib, if she hasn't tried that, if there isn't a reason not to try that, or asciminib, because if it's looking, you can look at this in two ways. One is that, as Jorge mentioned, maybe this is somebody who's never going to meet formal criteria for TKI withdrawal, in which case maintaining quality of life is really important. And so I would, if that were the case, then I would just basically say, let's switch you, just try switching to something else and see if it, you know, if your quality of life improves and there's every expectation that you're going to maintain this level of molecular remission. The other thing I would say is that she's been really close to MR4 consistently. You know, but these ones that are not MR4 are like 0.11 or 0.12. I don't know that I would put so much stock in the test, because if she went to a different lab, it might be a little bit lower, it might be a little bit higher. But if the patient was really motivated to stop treatment, you know, as long as they understood that it would be formally deviating from the recommendations for stopping, I think the risk is low, especially if you continue to use loss of MR3 as your you know, threshold for resuming treatment. But I would obviously involve the patient in that discussion, and you know, because you know these thresholds are arbitrary. They're a byproduct of our base 10 number system at the end of the day.
Michael, agree, disagree, or in between?
I might say in between. I like Neil's point about the close to being MR4. I think that time on treatment is probably going to be something to look at in this patient's case. I also agree with the idea about switching, because living on Imodium is not a great lifestyle if you can help it, if there are other options. And there's some science behind why some patients have PCR signals that look like they're still fairly positive, but they've been stable and low, and they may still be amenable to TFR. We may be looking at, you know, BCR-ABL signaling coming from lymphocytes, B and T cells. It's not ready for prime time, but it's really intriguing because I don't know if we have a clear answer that the PCR level is as informative as we'd like it to be. Yes, we have data on MR4.5 versus MR4. Yes, there's data on digital drop PCR being able to predict patients with greater TFR success, but I don't think it's crystal clear. I think there are some patients that we can't call, so I would remain hopeful that TFR could be an option, and I encourage optimizing her day to day and, you know, in the present.
All right, let's bring in another case. Tina, you have a 57-year-old woman.
Yeah, I had a 57-year-old woman who was diagnosed with CML like 16 years ago and initially treated with imatinib, did very well on it from a disease standpoint until 2012. She'd basically been on it for 4 years because of diarrhea. She was dose reduced to 300 milligrams and was briefly switched to dasatinib, but due to severe fatigue, went back on imatinib for 400 milligrams a day and thought it was fine. And she was able to obtain and sustain a deep molecular remission. So we fast forward to January of 2022, and because she has had such a deep molecular remission, I don't have those values from eons ago, but they looked similar to what you're seeing on the screen, which is, you know, basically MMR 4.5 or a CMR. And so she ended up stopping imatinib because she met discontinuation criteria and was bothered by arthralgias. Soon after, like maybe a month or two after she stopped the drug, she developed profound fatigue. She's a vice principal and has a lot of responsibilities related to that, as well as bone and joint pain, shoulders, hands, like everything was just aching. And so she was diagnosed with TKI withdrawal syndrome and was treated with steroids and did temporarily okay on the steroids. But after the steroids were removed, her symptoms sort of came back. And so it prompted reinitiation of treatment with her TKI, her symptoms completely resolved after she started the medication. And she's kind of in this place where she does not want to be on her TKI anymore, but she also does not want to have a flare of those withdrawal symptoms. And so over time, we gradually reduced her imatinib dose kind of per her preference. differences, and she's now on 100 milligrams daily. That's been since January of this year, and she just called my office 2 weeks ago, basically saying that she has, you know, recurrence of the fatigue and the joint pain similar to what she had when she originally tried coming off imatinib. So my question is, how often have you personally seen TKI withdrawal symptoms in your practice, and how have you managed those patients? And whether you've been able to identify any, sorry, patient or disease factors that would predict for this.
Jorge?
Well, you know, it varies how the frequency varies. You know, there's been reports that say that it's 30 to 40% of patients. Some, you know, I've seen reports as high as that. I don't think it's quite that high. Now, it could be that you have a very low threshold to call something a withdrawal syndrome. And then, you know, many patients qualify for that. To me, it's more, you know, 15 to 20% of patients that have a withdrawal syndrome. And in the overwhelming majority of instances, it's either, minimal that it doesn't need intervention or resolves or responds well to, non-steroidals. Rarely do I need to use, corticosteroids. But I do have a handful of patients, but probably more than a handful, where the only thing that has worked has been to resume the TKI. And I've done, you know, similar to what you've done here, find what's the lowest that they can take. And, you know, sometimes it takes very little, but some patients you need to keep going up until it's enough for the patient, for the symptoms to go away. And those are challenging because in this particular patient, for example, the patient wants to come off. On the other hand, you don't have, you know, perhaps the quality of life with the withdrawal syndrome is worse than the quality of life of what she may have been experiencing with the TKI. You know, I recently had a patient who was in the medical field, and, she was on a wheelchair. She had to stop working and all that because of the withdrawal syndrome. So she's back on her TKI and she's now, you know, doing all her normal activities and so on. And, you know, she just, acknowledged that she's going to need to continue on that. These are very rare, very, infrequent, scenarios. But when they come, you know, many times that's the only thing that's gonna that I know that works in those patients.
Michael, any comments about your experience, and also what's the presumed pathophysiology of why this happens?
I'm glad you're asking, Michael.
Yeah, because I'll have a crystal clear answer. I think we postulate these short-term briefs, you know, six weeks out for a few weeks or months, some arthralgias and inflammatory symptoms to KIT react, you know, to KIT activation. You have a, you know, an off-target KIT inhibition. You don't have KIT inhibition. So if you have KIT overactivity, over signaling, that's an inflammatory. Mast cells, mediators of inflammation could be a mechanism. That's why we recommend antihistamines as part of the, and, you know, the first thing is to tell patients if they have symptoms. My immediate reaction to this case was, though, that how is it that someone didn't have a condition, they start on a TKI, and then now they now have a condition that requires a TKI in the inflammatory autoimmune rheumatologic space? So I definitely get people over to rheumatology and see if we've either unmasked through TKI exposure, or something developed, and ironically we were treating it and now it's quite manifest. And sure, resuming the TKI is not unreasonable, especially if it's a low-risk TKI like imatinib. But I've had a couple of, as I think we all have a handful, as Jorge said. I don't know if it's better, but I've diagnosed people with other rheumatologic conditions and they've had appropriate treatment for that rather than having to stay on the TKI as an alternative. I'm not sure how often that is. There may be some patients who have some sort of shift in their phenotype where the TKI is the solution. But I certainly have seen the opposite. I've seen lupus and I've seen other conditions sort of become manifest. Some of the TKIs might do it. You know, I think to say in them, but not to, again, cast aspersions. I think it does have an inflammatory immune, you know, potential mediator. I see toxicities linger beyond it. So that might be another way to look at it.
Good point. Yeah. All right. Amanda, 54-year-old woman with accelerated phase CML.
Yes. So this is a 54-year-old female who has accelerated CML. At the time of diagnosis, she had clonal evolution. She also had a translocation 1-4 and an ASXL1 mutation. So she initially presented in August of 2022 with massive splenomegaly, 30 centimeters, a CBC with a white count of 411, hemoglobin of 8.5, platelets 366, basophils were 13%, blasts of 10%. She was started on nilotinib 300 twice a day and then quickly had a dose reduction to 150 milligrams daily with severe pancytopenia. Her transcript level at diagnosis was 35%, and she was pancytopenic for 5 months at the time, and she was found to have a CYP3A polymorphism. She was started on asciminib 80 milligrams daily at that time and was pancytopenic again for another 7 months. She's transfusion dependent, and then she was again off her TKI. Luckily, we didn't get any infections. Now she's on asciminib 20 milligrams twice weekly. Her ANC is about 1, and her platelets are 20 to 30,000. She's on N-plate. And you can see that her transcript level is still anywhere between 30 and 50%. She does have the ASXL1 mutation, which is hovering between 5 and 10%. And there were a few other values, maybe at UCSF or different hospital, that were around the same here. So my questions about this case are the interpretation of the ASXL1 mutation and how you really monitor clonal evolution in all patients. If you start with just a translocation 922, are we periodically checking, you know, cytogenetics or just transcript levels? And how should we manage patients with CYP3A polymorphisms?
So, Neil, the two of you shared the case, or what happened?
Yeah, so this patient was originally, she's from San Diego. She was originally seen at UCSD, and I kind of got involved a little bit later after the prolonged cytopenias. So I've never actually seen her in person. I've only, you know, seen her remotely. You know, she was reluctant to have transplant. She was, you know, she was obviously counseled at UCSD. I think she sought out another opinion or another center, and that's how she saw Dr. Blackman at City of Hope. And I think if she's going to have a transplant, she said she will have it at the City of Hope. And I've certainly told her that I'm not encouraged about her long term, you know, or that I'm not encouraged that things are likely to change for the better. If she stays on medical therapy, obviously if she wants to, and, you know, hopefully things will be stable, but, you know, it is concerning that she's got these other mutations. The GATA3 we think is germline, the ASXL1, and it hasn't risen. At the same time, you know, it's there. So
any teaching points you'd like to make about this case, Neil, and anything you'd like to see Jorge comment on about the case?
Oh, I would love to hear anybody comment, but the CYP3A4 polymorphism, again, I mean, I think, I don't know how often people are checking for this, but again, what piqued my interest in that was just the rapid and prolonged pancytopenia. Obviously, you know, one worries about the underlying health of the bone marrow environment. There's no reason a priori why hers is so, you know, so ineffective at restoring hematopoiesis. And I guess, you know, I think Dr. Blackman asked me about suggested transplant regimens, and once they get to transplant, I just hand them off. So I don't have any thoughts. And so I think if, you know, people's thoughts about that would be great as well.
Jorge?
Well, you know, first I think that, yeah, this is a patient for transplant. I think that, you know, there's a couple of elements of why this may be happening, and certainly the polymorphism is a possibility, but I think that the fact that there are all these additional mutations These patients tend to get more myelosuppressed. You know, this is probably one of these instances where you have these cytopenias of unknown significance, and they frequently come with molecular abnormalities and so on. And in this case, it's together with a diagnosis of CML. You know, you manage with whatever you can, and this patient is unlikely to respond. And if she does, it's probably going to be a very short-lived response. So, we talked a little earlier about these mutations and whether you should be checking initially at the time of diagnosis or not. And, there's considerations why you could or could not be doing them upfront. But on a patient that goes through this path, I think you always need to check them, because that is where you see an overrepresentation of these patients. And what I'm doing is moving my transplant up frequently, much, much earlier in these kind of patients. Because we know that this is not going to be better with TKIs. Actually, with asciminib, we do have data that patients that have, these type of mutations progress more, on asciminib. They progress more than patients that don't have those mutations. So we already have data with asciminib showing that this is a bad scenario for asciminib as well.
The last thing I'll say is, with the variant allele frequencies, one of the things that I mentioned to the patient that we unfortunately don't know is, you know, is the ASXL1 that's there at low frequency now, is it in her CML cells or is it in her pH negative cells, right? And so you could imagine that part of her inability to restore hematopoiesis may be because she's got some underlying MDS. And that's kind of like part of why I think we've been like trying to, you know, in the old days, we would do karyotypic analysis, look for, you know, trisomy 8 or other changes. And now, of course, we can feel a little bit better that we're looking, you know, a lot more granular level at what may be evolving. But it's still really early days. And yeah, this case definitely, you know, has been very, very challenging. And, you know, I don't see, you know, long-term improvement with medical therapy, unfortunately.
Jorge?
Well, and I was just going to point out that in addition, she also has a DNMT3A mutation. So I think it is very possible that this patient has something else hematologically there in the non-CML clone.
I did check Amanda? The bone marrow. A recent bone marrow did not have MDS, but morphologically at least. But yeah, I think that will impact also the decision about conditioning regimens and how to transplant her if we think she could have MDS as well. Our center, you know, the older data using Bu-Sci and tacromethotrexate, we've started to do fludarabine and melphalan with tacro-siro. Standardly here, but the patient is very afraid of GVHD, as am I. And she's interested in pursuing an ORCA-T or ORCA-Q trial. So that's something we're considering, or post-transplant cyclophosphamide, though the experience with that is relatively limited.
All right, let's go on to another case. Tina, you have a 73-year-old lady.
Yeah, so I also saw this 73-year-old lady on the inpatient consult service who was diagnosed with CML in 2012 and was on imatinib for about 7 years before she was switched to bosutinib 500 milligrams daily because she lost her major molecular response on imatinib. She was able to achieve a complete molecular remission on bosutinib as of June of 2019, but had trouble with pleural effusions, which were attributed to bosutinib. She had a couple of thoracentesis and was dose reduced to 300 milligrams daily of bosutinib, and was taking it until last spring when she was again admitted to the hospital. And that's when I met her for the first time because she had recurrent pleural effusions. And she was done with bosutinib at that point. And we were having this discussion about where we go from here. We talked about TKI discontinuation because she had been in a complete molecular remission for several years, but she was worried that her CML all would flare up off of anything. And so I recommended asciminib, and she started 80 milligrams of asciminib 2 months later in May. And she called into the clinic because she said that she had worsening shortness of breath on asciminib, and she thought it was all asciminib's fault. And so we held her treatment for 2 weeks, and I called her again, and she said that she was feeling a lot better, and I instructed her to resume asciminib at a lower dose of 40 milligrams daily, but she didn't do that. She was going on vacation with her family. She was like, I do not want to have any TKI-related problems when I'm on vacation. I'll start it when I come back, but she never did. And so now she's been off all TKI therapy since June of 2023. She's still in a complete molecular remission, no recurrent effusions, and is very happy with her quality of life. So my question is, you know, asciminib, I think its biggest selling point is its tolerability over TKIs. And so I just wanted to know if you have seen people tolerate it poorly and how you've managed those toxicities and your approach to dose reduction.
Michael?
Well, I was just going to comment on the case. This is sort of a TKI, UDI, like unanticipated drug interruption. I think we all have probably a handful of those cases too. And you did a great job getting her in remission with bosutinib. So that really, because that period of lack of MMR and imatinib, that could have been a stumbling block, and I'm glad she's stable. So asciminib's not perfect. You know, I think I always describe it as it pulls in some adverse events from all of the drugs we've seen, you know, lipase elevation, hypertension, thrombocytopenia, fatigue, arthralgias, myalgias, et cetera, hypersensitivity. You're going to have cross intolerance, I think, with some certain patients. If we look at why we have adverse events, are they on target or off target? Hard to separate them entirely. So I would have liked to have seen her try the lower dose of asciminib to see if it was a dose related toxicity. But again, it's a happy ending. So asciminib, well, it's very well tolerated and has a more lean side effect profile, and mechanistically may have less off-target effects. We still don't understand, you know, where's the pancreas target? That all of the drugs basically across the board have some risk of lipase elevation. Maybe it's something similar in the cardiopulmonary space where you can trigger symptoms like this. Not to throw the patient, under the bus, but she probably was pretty worried about starting another drug and having the same toxicity recur. So, you know, sometimes a thorough workup and a hold and a reassurance might have bridged her, but she didn't need it. So I think we just have to manage accordingly and in an anticipatory fashion. But asciminib at lower doses, I think, may hold some power. We started at 10, 20 milligrams in the phase one. I think many of us have patients on lower doses from our trial experience that are doing quite well. So wouldn't use it routinely, but I think much like our other TKIs, there may be some room there. And I think your intentions were good, and your ending was happy.
Thank you.
I like that. Jorge, any comments, Jorge?
Just to add to what Mike mentioned, as he said, you know, asciminib is very good, but it's not perfect. And just as a reminder, even in frontline, in the ask for first, there were 5% of patients who discontinued because of adverse events. That was half of what happened with the other TKIs, so it's less common. But even in a frontline setting when there's no all the background of previous therapies and so on, and it was just, you know, one of these and one of that, there's no pattern. But there's always going to be a patient who just cannot take whatever you give them.
This is another one of those cases where the nature of the side effects, I mean, pleural effusions with bosutinib, pretty uncommon, you know, especially in a patient that's not had prior dasatinib therapy. So this, again, is somebody, I don't know if she's not taken a lot of medications in the past, but this is somebody that you may consider doing one of these CYP polymorphism tests on. I do have some patients on as low a dose of asciminib as 20 milligrams, and sometimes even like three times a week. As others have said, you know, it does have some side effects, and some patients don't tolerate it better than other TKIs. But, you know, I'm usually pretty aggressive at trying to maximize quality of life in patients once they're responding well. And so I'm a little bit more aggressive with dose reductions probably than most people, but it's given me confidence that in select cases, you know, less doses and infrequent can be effective and well tolerated.
So a 34-year-old man, Amanda, what happened with him?
So this is a 34-year-old male who developed splenomegaly, left upper quadrant pain, and 25-pound weight loss, prompting him to go to the ER. His white blood cell count was 787, hemoglobin of 9.7, platelets of 425. He didn't have any peripheral blasts and 3% basophils. Bone marrow at the time in chronic phase. He has this three-way translocation between 1, 9, and 22 in all 20 metaphases. So he had a CT at the time, which was kind of interesting, with huge hepatosplenomegaly, prominent retroperitoneal and pelvic lymphadenopathy. He had a 7.9-centimeter soft tissue lesion and some nodular soft tissue density along the anterior penile subcutaneous soft tissues. None of this was biopsied at the time. This was all done at a different hospital and then came to me kind of as a consult to see if he needed a transplant, actually. And I was a little bit confused about the consult. I rescanned him. He didn't have any hepatosplenomegaly, no lymphadenopathy. He's been on bosutinib 400 milligrams daily. There was a brief treatment interruption because his insurance wouldn't cover the drug. And now his latest BCR ABL is 0.16. So he met the 6-month time point. At 12 months, he was briefly off treatment. And then now his level is pretty low. So my questions would be, you know, what do we think about a three-way translocation and these less common cytogenetic abnormalities?
So, Michael?
Where do you guys find these cases? These are breaking some personal records for height of white count.
West Virginia.
Yeah. You know, bring your spleen in a wheelbarrow kind of situation.
They come to see me during my first year of being an attending. That's where they...
Well, hats off to you guys for these bringing these forward, you know, and managing them. It's remarkable how well this patient has actually done, because I'm reading through the history and I'm assuming that this might be extramedullary blast phase transformation or a different disease. That doesn't mean the bosutinib wouldn't work necessarily, but it certainly is very high grade, high risk disease. To get to the question, Neil and Jorge may be able to correct me, but I don't believe that we feel that three-way translocations like this, especially with certain partner chromosomes, will have a significant impact on disease biology. Because if you still have, you know, ABL fusion, you may have other partners involved, but it may have a non-clinical impact. So I generally treat them like I treat sole standard PH translocation. That being said, you know, all the other features of this case I would have been very nervous along the way. And obviously you had to navigate gaps in treatment and you know, getting therapy for the patient. So I'm glad he's near MMR. I think that's remarkable. It's taken a while, so that's a bit of a challenge. But again, answering that primary question, I think that was the least of his worries. I think the kinetic growth of the disease might have been neglected, might not have been able to get to medical care for a while. But thank goodness that it worked. And I would continue to look for mutations as you have, because you still have a fairly high disease burden. Might be interesting to look at secondary mutations in a case like this. We talked about this earlier. When are we going to learn from sort of other myeloid mutations and how they affect the outcome? In cases like this, I think when you, at the beginning, doing everyone may not be as high yield as doing it now to understand how, with this, because he's 34 and, you know, and approaching a better remission, but you know, transplant's probably also something to talk about in a case like this, because if he doesn't get into a deeper remission or clearly into a stable MMR, he may not, you know, have long-term success with TKI therapy only. So those are some thoughts.
Jorge, anything you want to add to that?
I would just confirm what Mike said. You know, we looked at these some time ago, and the data mostly comes from imatinib because that was when we started having these questions about these patients, and it was shown that these three-way translocations did not these variant translocations, either the simple or the complex like this one, it did not adversely affect the outcome of patients. They frequently come with that deletion of derivative 9. And both of these things were historically of adverse prognosis with interferon. But they lost the prognostic significance once we started treating patients with tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So, you know, you just really need to, you can continue following them with a regular PCR and so on. And yeah, I mean, these patients responding well, a little slower than you would prefer to see, but I'm okay with that, with the response where the patient is, and I would not do anything different.
Tina, let's hear about this 36-year-old man.
This is a gentleman who I originally took care of when I was working at Ohio State, and who basically followed me to West Virginia. But anyway, he is a 36-year-old guy, really no medical comorbidities. He was diagnosed with CML in 2017 after he presented with a major splenomegaly and a white count of 168,000. His bone marrow biopsy at that time showed pretty like garden variety CML, translocation 922, no secondary chromosome abnormality. It is not my practice to check NGS studies on these patients. He started dasatinib 100 milligrams initially, and he stayed on it for about 2 years, but had numerous treatment holds and dose reductions for grade 4 thrombocytopenia. But his BCR-ABL was trending down nicely, and he met criteria for major molecular response. But ultimately, due to the persistent cytopenias, in September of 2019, he was switched to bosutinib 500 milligrams daily and remained on it for about a year. He had a suboptimal molecular response on bosutinib, so he had Abl kinase resistance testing, which showed the presence of a T315I gatekeeper mutation. He did have a prior one a year ago. Before that, which was negative for any resistance mutations. So he was started on 30 milligrams of ponatinib daily, and his PCR improved nicely to 1.88% from 36.7%, and was evaluated for stem cell transplant, but he really didn't want that. He's a young guy, three young kids, really didn't feel like he had the time for a transplant. And he actually saw one of you and was recommended to go on ponatinib at a dose of 45 milligrams per the OPTIC study, and then eventually dropped to 30 milligrams once major molecular response was reached. He did okay, but again, his PCR started rising and he lost his MMR a few years after being on ponatinib. Had a bone marrow biopsy at that time, which showed the T315I mutation on the resistance panel. And then he also had ASXL1 and three different BCORL1 mutations, as well as a new inversion 3 on his cytogenetics. And so he started asciminib and was on it for about 6 months before he progressed to blast phase CML. Long story long, he went on to have induction chemotherapy followed by a transplant. He's doing okay right now. And so my questions are, at what point in these patients with T315I mutations do you do transplant versus like ponatinib or asciminib? And is it a given that all of these patients will require a transplant at some point?
So who is the second opinion?
Dr. Cortez.
So we'll start with you, Jorge. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, if you're okay with it, your connection to the case and what your thoughts are about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I got involved there with the ponatinib, and you know, we do know that with ponatinib and with asciminib, dose are important for T359. In this OPTIC study, in this randomized study, clearly in the T359, there's a big difference in the probability of response between between 45 and 30. And then in asciminib, the dose that you need for T359 is five times the dose of the non-T359 patients. So they both work in the T359, but they're dose dependent, clearly. So unfortunately, we know that although both drugs are very good in that setting, it's not 100% response. You know, the response rate with ponatinib, even at 45, it's about 60%. And this patient, well, was not one of those. So now in terms of the question as to whether I would transplant, at what point would I transplant a patient with T315I? I don't tend to transplant them just because they have T315I. There is an analysis, and it's retrospective, and it's based on databases. So obviously there's that caveat. But comparing the data with ponatinib from the clinical trials to the data from the European Bone Marrow Transplant Registry, the survival is better for patients, treated with ponatinib than with the transplant. That is if they're in the chronic phase. So I usually tend to give them the opportunity. Now that was in the days of ponatinib, I would assume that you would expect the same thing with asciminib. If you were to do that same comparison. But I think once a patient has a failure to one of these two drugs, you need to be ready to do the transplant, even if they're still in the chronic phase. You know, there's much less, you know, wiggling room there. You may change to the other one while you prepare the patient for transplant, but I think that that's less likely to be an improvement long-term, particularly for a young patient like this.
So, Neil, anything you want to add to that?
When the patient lost response to ponatinib, it would have been nice to have another mutation assessment, because if you know that there's, you know, more than one mutation, then really all bets are off as far as asciminib treatment goes. Asciminib could be, there's no harm in trying it, but, you know, at that point, certainly lining up the ducks, I think, for transplants would make sense. And the other thing I would comment on is, 3Q26, chromosome 3Q26 abnormalities. You said this patient had inversion 3 abnormality. Those are associated with a higher risk of progression to blast crisis. So, if you do detect those in the chronic phase, that's another indication to at least begin the process of transplant evaluation and continue to watch them, like a hawk.
Michael?
Yeah, I was just going to echo. I think Neil, he was reading my mind. You dropped a couple of juicy bits in there where the patient, at the time of switch to asciminib, had the B-Core and inversion 3. I think those are, B-Core is not necessarily known to be high risk, but is certainly described in myeloid malignancies, and the chromosome 3 abnormalities Neil just covered. Also, the high transcripts, failing ponatinib 45 with high transcripts. We do know that asciminib hasn't fared as well with high transcript patients in salvage for chronic phase. So that would have been the point when the transplant, if transformation could have been avoided, it would have been an option to elect at that point to say asciminib can be started while we prepare you for transplant to see if it has any effect, rather than maybe holding out for, you know, longer and allow it, but it probably was pretty quick, I fear. It was just looks like 4 months or 6 months of exposure. So it was in the cards, unfortunately. So lesson learned.
Any other comments or questions about this case?
Yes. I'm just wondering about the transplant regimen. So in a young patient, did he have other comorbidities, or he wasn't given myeloablative conditioning?
I'm not sure. I'm not a transplanter myself. So, that's ultimately what, he received from his transplant team. He really did not have much in the way of medical comorbidities. So, the rationale behind his conditioning regimen, I couldn't really speak to. But ultimately, you know, there were a lot of other, and I think we see this a lot in these younger individuals, these adolescent and young adult age group who are sort of in the thick of life. It's sometimes difficult to manage them due to competing life priorities, and that's general, and that is what happened in this case, because he was referred for transplant multiple times and basically declined until, you know, the horse was out of the barn. So just another sort of social aspect of what we struggle with sometimes.
So a couple other things I'd like to do before we finish. First, I want to go back to Tina and Amanda and ask if there are any questions they'd like to verbalize.
I would like to hear you guys talk about your incorporation or thoughts on some of, I think it's the Destiny data with like the TKI maintenance approach. So basically in patients who are not necessarily candidates for TKI discontinuation, but have achieved a deep molecular remission, how often do you just sort of have the dose of the TKI that they're on, and which patients do you consider that in? Do you think it's a reasonable approach?
Neil?
So I will frequently dose reduce. I don't necessarily go by half, you know, but I will frequently dose reduce in patients if they're interested. Now, if a patient has absolutely no toxicity and they're in a deep molecular response and they have no interest in stopping treatment, because some patients don't want to stop treatment, they don't want to deal with the more frequent blood testing required, or you know, maybe they are a little bit concerned that there have been some anecdotal cases of blastic transformation, you know, down the road. It's very rare, but it's not unheard of. And so I will commonly, you know, involve them in the discussion as to whether they want to potentially dose reduce. Many will, because the idea of, you know, being spared drug exposure, even, you know, even if it's not completely, but just being exposed to less, can be quite appealing.
Thank you. Amanda, any questions?
I have a couple of things. First, I think talking about pregnancy management in these patients. So what is your cutoff? Do you go until a complete cytogenetic response or major molecular, and especially in your patients who are in their late 30s?
Jorge?
Well, I'm assuming that you're referring to a planned pregnancy. If the patient who wants to become pregnant brings that up to you, and you're trying to help her find the right setting. And I ask that because there's the other scenarios which are more complex, which is the patient who's pregnant and while pregnant diagnosed with CML, or the patient with an unplanned pregnancy who's not giving you the him or her the time to prepare for when to become pregnant. In that instance, again, it is a discussion with the patient. The lower the level, the better. Because part of my approach with pregnant women has been to be very minimalistic. I don't give them anything during pregnancy. I don't use interferon. So I know the transcripts are going to go up, but usually nothing happens. It's just the transcripts go up. So, but the lower you start, the more room you have for that increase in the transcripts. And you know, it at least gives more reassurance to the patient and also to you. So it depends on what the patient feels in terms of, how long they're willing to wait, how immediate is their desire to have a baby, and so on, and then try to get them to the best possible point I can before they become pregnant. So I don't have a specific threshold. I just want to understand from the patient their timelines, their goals, and explain what the approach will be and what I'm expecting during the interruption of the treatment during the pregnancy.
Jorge, can you bring in the other two scenarios, the patient who becomes diagnosed while during pregnant and the patient who becomes pregnant after diagnosis?
The most challenging one is a patient who is diagnosed while pregnant, because, you know, by definition, the disease is full-blown active. And part of that depends on what stage of the pregnancy you are, what trimester of the pregnancy. If it's very early, if it's in the first trimester, you have probably a high white cell count, big spleen, maybe symptoms, and then you have the pregnancy. Again, I am very minimalistic. In those instances, you know, if I can delay any intervention until the second trimester, when most drugs become more, safer to use, then I prefer to do that. Some are a little bit more, at least in animal studies, more teratogenic, and there's more data for imatinib, for example, on teratogenesis, and for others like nilotinib. For others, we don't have any data. The other thing is that the problem with interferon in a scenario like that is that it takes way too long to work, you know, to bring the white cell count down, and even the, and even more, the Philadelphia chromosome, it takes way longer to work. So if I can wait for the second trimester and I need to bring the white cell count down, I prefer a TKI, or if anything, hydroxyurea. I give them very short pulses of hydroxyurea. But that's, but the goal is to try to get through the first trimester. If, and I don't worry too much about a high white cell count. You know, the white cell count is 60. I don't, you know, it's okay. If it's 100, it's okay. As long as the patient is doing well and the baby's doing well. I always work with a high risk pregnancy specialist of obstetrician, so that they can help me monitor the baby and make sure that the health of the baby and the mother are okay, aside from the CML, because it's not just the CML that we need to worry about.
So, second opinion from Michael.
I agree on most of those points. Just to take Jorge's point even further, you know, as low as you can go. So, you know, even best case scenario, you have a woman who wants to get pregnant, she has CML, you're treating her and you're telling her, okay, when is the window going to open? Even if you get to TFR eligibility, then you have a 50% chance of success there. You know, so I'm often at this crossroads with women saying, should I try to conceive when I start TFR? Do I have to wait for 6 months? Do I have to wait for 18 months? It really is probably going to be as low as you can possibly get for as long as you possibly can, following the women's choice and understanding the risks and benefits. I personally do use interferon, although I admit it's slow as molasses and sometimes doesn't work, although I've seen it all. I think it may offer some buffer. I try to get the white count normal before delivery if I can. And I definitely, increasingly, I just literally yesterday got news from an obstetrician delivering a woman who had imatinib that we started in the third trimester because she was diagnosed in pregnancy. Interferon was ineffective. She had just a very stable blood count around 120 to 150. Amanda brought it back her into a hematologic remission, smooth sailing right to delivery, and she delivered a healthy baby boy. So I don't think it's sanctioned by the FDA by pregnancy category, but the aggregate data nicely summarized by some good registries shows that Amanda in late pregnancy is probably not very, very much of a risk, but definitely need high risk and careful monitoring.
Very interesting. Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree that, you know, imatinib after the first trimester, I think the available data suggests that it's reasonably safe. Now, of course, many pregnant people may not be interested in taking anything. And, you know, in those cases, I might suggest interferon if necessary. One other thing I'll just add to the equation is that, the disease kinetics of patients is different off of treatment. And some people, in my experience, you know, despite starting close to MMR, don't get any higher than like 10-15% at the end of term, and maybe some mild leukocytosis. In contrast, I had a patient who stopped treatment who was close to MMR simply to undergo oocyte stimulation for IVF. And in 6 weeks off of treatment, not only did she lose MMR, but her white count went up to 120,000. That was very shocking, obviously. But, you know, that's a challenging case because I don't know how I'm going to possibly keep her off of treatment long enough to carry through the first trimester. So in that case, we're talking about surrogates. But I think the ideal scenario, you know, is unfortunately rare, you know, that you're going to find somebody who's in a stable deep molecular response who can stop treatment and not have to resume treatment. But I do absolutely agree with Jorge that, you know, in most cases, you know, you don't have to really worry unless the white count gets, you know, really high. In which case, if the patient's reluctant to take anything, you know, it's not optimal, but there is also leukapheresis as an option.
So I'm going to give Tina the opportunity to ask the final question here.
Yeah, I see a lot of different practices in terms of disease monitoring in CML. And some programs that I've listened to have basically said that we are monitoring these patients too frequently. And how you know, what are the best intervals to monitor these people and what are you monitoring? Have we moved away from peripheral blood FISH, for example, and are just sticking to the PCR in order to get the best idea of how someone's CML is doing? And so I see varying practices out here. So I think if you could summarize your, you know, your best practices and your approach to just disease monitoring in stable patients.
That's an awesome question, Jorge.
What I do is when I start a patient on a treatment frontline or a new treatment, I do it every 3 months. Once my patient is stable on achieves a major molecular response or, you know, around there and it's stable, I go to every 6 months. I think that that's plenty for most patients. If I do a change, if I change of TKI, if I change the dose significantly, something like that, I may check again in 3 months to see that I'm not losing or a response or anything like that. But other than that, I don't think you need to stay on every 3 months indefinitely. Once a patient is stable, has a good response, and to me, the threshold is MMR, that's every 6 months works, has worked very well for my practice.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty and to our case presenters, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Current Management of Chronic Myeloid Leukemia.